And married me a wife, she gave me trouble all my life. Drove me out in the cold rain and snow. Rain and snow, rain and snow, rain and snow, rain and snow. Drove me out in the cold rain and snow. You know, that's not my culture. Like, you know, to say, oh, American, and identify, like, you know, Jewish kids from Chicago, you know, identifying with that is just a little bit, it's like, you know, Jewish kids from Chicago, you know, being the hottest Hawaiian guitar players around. There's something wrong there somewhere. And it's, you know, it's not because they're Jewish, it's not even because they're from Chicago, it's because it's whether they're making a mistake, you know, thinking that by, you know, reproducing licks, they're doing what that meant. I can reproduce the licks of that kind of music in my voice. It doesn't mean it's my music or anything more than the fact that I like it. It's something. I mean, it's sometimes people are suspicious of my identification with Irish music. You know, why would I do it? You know, either they make some kind of stupid, obvious thing like, oh, you're Irish American, that therefore you identify with it. You know, no. I mean, I'm Irish American, but I identify with Indian music. You know, it doesn't make me that either. It's something about the music itself that is the compelling thing. Not me or my imagined genetic connections with it.
And then the claim that there was a John Dowd, at least Coleman said it, that there was a John Dowd, that's what Martin Wynn told me, that there was a John Dowd and that Coleman said, I never could play like John Dowd. And there was a Matty Killoran, nothing to Paddy Killoran. And Ladd and them, he always said that he was great too. And there was a Jack McHugh around there, great musician. There was another guy, the name of Scanlon. They used to call him Kipping Scanlon. He called the bow the Kipping. And he used to go to Scotland. He was a kind of, he used to go to Scotland and he came back. And he used to bring tunes from Scotland over and play in Philip Burns. And then they brushed up a lot of them, and that's like Miss McLeod's and Lord MacDonald's and all them was Scotch, and the Banks and all that. They used to do a job on them. That's what I hear anyway. There was a Joseph Gallagher. They called him Joe Lackey. He lived about 2 miles away from me as the crow flies. He was a great player. He was a great player. And Phil McConnell, two of the best that I knew before I went to America. And then I had a few with the Decca, and my mother was a great player. I had a few with the Decca Records that time, and I was playing them until the war out.
I am from an island off the coast of California, off the coast of Southern California, called Santa Catalina, although everybody calls it Catalina now, not Santa Catalina. It's the only Santa or San, the only Spanish name place in all of America that's actually lost the holy part at the front of it because it's too many syllables for the English-speaking voice. As a matter of fact, it's a nice place. Kind of like Ireland, in fact, because although it's excessively beautiful and a wonderful place to be, if you are from there, you have to leave in order to gain education and or employment. It's very difficult to actually find some way to live on the island itself. I left first when I was 7. My two brothers were older. My mother was a romantic and made my father get jobs in weird places like Afghanistan and Ethiopia. And the first place, in fact, was Afghanistan, but there was a war going on, so we didn't get to join him. But her idea in making him get jobs in weird places was so that she could go be Bona Makubwa and stuff, because she had read all kinds of Isaac Dinesen and Lawrence Durrell, and she just thought this life abroad for the European/American was something to be experienced at the very least. So I had the experience from the age of 7 until I was 10 of living in the wilder parts of Ethiopia. But then, because my mother had fallen in love, on the way back we stopped over for a few months in Lebanon, which was absolute paradise after Ethiopia. So we moved back there after 2 years in the States in 1955 when I was 11 years old. We moved to Beirut, and I, in fact, grew up, spent the next 6 years in Beirut, graduated from high school there. I started at the local English language Arab school. It was a boys' school for 3 years, and then this American school down the hill from us was in plain view, and girls back in those days wore those big dresses with the petticoats underneath them, and they're all these bright pastels, and you could see them a mile away. Just the concept of females at about age 14 was too much, so I made my mother put me and my brother into the school down the hill. So I actually graduated from the last 3 years of high school were at this American community school, which is basically the same school, only it had mostly Americans in it and girls. But I made friends. My brother and I made friends with people from all over the Middle East, Iraqis and Jordanians and Syrians and Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, Turkish Cypriots, all kinds of people who just found themselves for various reasons at one of these two schools that we attended there. I also started sailing a great deal. My first passion, the first activity that I had a passion for was sailing, sailboats and that kind of thing. I was raised in the shade of the cedars of Lebanon, and I bathed in the bay where sailors mind the sand, then gave the glass to man and on his kind, past the side of land. They rode on ships to Spain for what they'd find, past the side of land. We'll come back home again with what we find.
Tully Cooley, Dromahaire, just about 3 miles outside the town. A nice little place, plenty of nice scenery, but you can't live on scenery alone. And it was very hard for the people around there to make ends meet. And there was no work for me, period. And I was raised on a farm. And when you'd bring cattle out to a fair and coming back and you're wet, trying to sell them, I decided that it was time to bail out. Try for something better. I went to America. I was 11 days by boat. I left on around the 5th of December, and I arrived there on Christmas. I went to Cove and Cork and went out in a tender. The tender took us out to the boat, and we looked back at Ireland, and there was no one laughing. It was all sad eyes, and it was 11 days then, the waves lapping, and you couldn't even sleep in bed. There was a couple of bunk beds in it, and there was an old man sleeping under, he was upstairs in that bunk bed, and he was afraid he'd fall out of the bed, and it was very rough. So anyway, we arrived in Halifax in Canada. We got out that night. Everyone was let off the boat. And I was like a young calf after getting out when I arrived and landed. A great feeling of something solid under my feet. And we started the next day down the Hudson to New York, and arrived in New York. And back from that, I had never any regrets from it. I didn't like it at first because I always wanted to come home. In fact, I was inclined to come back only for shame, cause I would have came back. But after a while I got a job, you find out you get a pension. And it was a better country that time than the one I left.
Cold War was in full swing, but nothing dangerous, nothing unpleasant, like shooting, you know, Asians or South Americans or anything like that. So I joined the Navy for 3 years, intending to be what they call a quartermaster, who's the sort of person who steers the ships and does navigation and that sorts of thing. But in their wisdom, they made me, because I passed certain tests at certain levels, they decided to make me a journalist. So they sent me, instead of sending me out to the fleet to be a ship driver, they sent me to journalist school, where I spent about 6 months learning how to produce newspapers and take photographs and develop them and radio technique and that sort of thing. And then instead of sending me off to do a ship or station newspaper or radio station or something like that, because I came in at the top of my class, they habitually sent the top graduates off to one of the fleet headquarters as a public information specialist. 18-year-old public information specialist. So I got sent to Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. It was my office and my shift that was in charge of things on the night of the Tonkin Gulf incident. Do you remember the Tonkin Gulf incident? That was the night when North Vietnamese speedboats allegedly came out and fired torpedoes at a couple of innocently patrolling American destroyers out in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is the waters off of North Vietnam. In my case, it was mostly I spent most of my time with either the junk forces, which was very exciting, despite the name. A junk forces were these sort of motor-powered little wooden boats that the Vietnamese used for just running around the coast and the river areas, checking for contraband, for arms shipments, and that sort of thing. And then the scarier bits were when I was with the Vietnamese Marines, because they got shot at a lot. They did an awful little amount of shooting back. I certainly did very little, but I spent an awful lot of time loving the dirt, and I'd gotten used to the sound of heavy weapons in Beirut, because I was there in 1958 when the 58 civil war happened, the sort of dress rehearsal for all the badness that happened in the 70s and 80s, and I could distinguish the sound of a 30 caliber machine gun from a 50 caliber machine gun and stuff like that, and I remember the occasional twig getting knocked off a tree in our front yard in Beirut by stray bullets. And I was quite unprepared for the fact that when a 50 caliber machine gun opens up in a forest, in a jungle area, a 50 caliber bullet can and will knock down entire trees. So at the end of whatever battles we were invariably found ourselves in, I was always under about 3 feet of fallen tree, feeling very safe as they... as these things piled in on top of me. While I was there, I noticed that the government was getting all of its intelligence, as it called it, from junior officers in the military, which is logically an extremely bad idea. A junior officer is somebody who's bound and determined that he's going to be a senior officer someday. And you can't do that in any military, let alone the American military, without a real war to prove your credentials of macho bravery and that sort of thing. So they were telling the U.S. government, right in front of us, if not blatant lies, then at least blatant distortions about what we could do, what we'd get away with, what toys we needed to do it with, and that kind of thing. And I was horrified when the government pursued, after I got out of the Navy and left Vietnam, the government pursued an ever more intensive participation, sending more and more troops in to fight the battle on the ground. This is against conventional wisdom on any scale. President Eisenhower had warned against getting involved in a land war in Asia. There's all kinds of cliches floating around, most of them against the war. The only cliches that you could find in support of it were more or less jingoistic, simplistic things. It was very easy for me as a semi-intellectual to combat with the people who mattered to me. My friends and my immediate family were people who I turned to in an effort to dissuade them from supporting the war. They thought at first that I was off my trolley because the American president doesn't lie to the people. Come boarding on the slate gray sea, the eye informs him endlessly. Horizon dawn surrounded night serene, and steady in his sights he measures time from fading stars. Brings down the sun to tell how far, to hear now the hidden pearl in bearings, wheels, and worms. And all true sailors go out for him. Where all true sailors see it always well. A wave as truth, the ocean as what might be. Where all true sailors see peach eternally. From weather, instinct, distant thrills, or duty, some will find a hill and rise to overlook the sea, where ocean dreams of what to be. Now ice and steam, now stormy thing, now rose to stream on ways to wing through time, the tunnel endless, brief to glory, God of grief. And all true sailors go atop a hill, where all true sailors see and always will. Ocean as what might be, where all true sailors reach eternally.
Well, I got very confused about it with the down. My sister-in-law took me down to Wall Street, and you look up at the sky and you could see no light at all. It was all a building. You couldn't, in fact, if you did put your head back to look up at the building, you'd fall over. They were that high. And I said, I could never work here. I could never work here. Little I knew that I'd be working down there in years to come. After a while, you get used to it. And New York has a name of hustle and bustle and running and racing and things like that. You don't have to. You can take your time and walk, and you'll just get there as fast. When I went there, I was about a week there, And my brother used to tell me about this great musician, Larry Byrne. And it was a Friday night, and he said, he's coming here tonight. So Lad came to the house. In fact, his first name is James O'Byrne. He's a son of Phil O'Byrne's, you know, that real Phil O'Byrne's delight. So he was supposed to teach Coleman. Anyway, Lad asked me to play a few tunes, and I played a few tunes. But in the end, I asked Lad. Lad took the fiddle and started playing, and I played the high level. And after a while, I gave the fiddle to Lad, and Lad played the high level. And I said to myself, I can't play at all. I know nothing about playing compared to the way he played it. I used to hear Coleman on a record on it. And there was another part in it that Lad put to it, and I thought it was very, very graceful. And I went out then the next day, and I was on the street. And didn't I see this big man on the street, and who was it? Only Lad. And I asked him where he was living. He said, I'm living just right up in that house up there. So for years, we were always pals and always played every weekend. Lad didn't like to be recorded. Him and Martin Wynne didn't like to be recorded at all. But if he went to his apartment, it was very hard to get him to play. And you took the fiddle and started playing. And he would say to you, isn't it as well to do it the right way as the wrong way? And you just say to him, well, I have it the wrong way, but I would like to get it the right way. You do it. And then he took the fiddle and started playing, and then he was off. He played for hours then. The Bronx was the place for the music. They were all in about 10 minutes walk apart. And it was always a Saturday night or a Sunday night. You went to a session in an apartment, and everyone that went in there, they always brought a bottle or something in, whether it was drank or not, they didn't go empty-handed, and they always brought a bottle in. It was a pleasure. But you'd come home and you'd have no tape recorder, and you'd go into the bathroom and close the door and close the window and put a mute on the fiddle and try to play what you heard. But then you'd have to get up in the morning.
So between the war, which I hated, and the general culture, which I was not in tune with, and Richard Nixon, whom I've always loathed, just the sight of the man used to make my gorge rise. He was doing things like cutting the funds out of the educational programs that, besides keeping me in college as a graduate student, they also paid the wages of most of the teachers of Russian in America. I was studying Russian at the time, not for any particular reason, just because it was the only interesting thing that they were offering when I started my studies. And was in my first year as a graduate student when Nixon cut the funds out of the program that was paying my way and paying the wages of most of the university professors of the language in America. So the net result was I couldn't hope to get any work at all as a Russian language specialist, because there were all these people with a lot more experience than me as teachers and as translators and stuff. And given this sort of uneducable, unemployed status, and the curious fact that the only thing in the world that made sense to me being some records that a friend of mine, Dennis Brooks, an American Ellen Piper who now lives in Cork, I met him in California in 1968, and when I expressed an interest in Irish music, he dragged me down to this Irish import shop in Los Angeles and had me buy the first two Chieftains albums and the wonderful King of the Pipers, one of the first Clutter records by Leo Rosum. And those three records, along with a record that I picked up myself called Shanarita Sagedi, was something that I could come home to from this silly job I had on the road stuffing psychedelic posters back into their plastic bags. It was the only thing that made any sense to me in the whole world. And I rationalized that this there had to be this country somewhere called Ireland that had values which were being spoken of in this music that I could understand or at least relate to. So I sold everything I had, packed up my family and my dog, and we set off to Ireland, arriving here only to find, in fact, that this is back in 1971, while the revival of interest in Irish music had started, even though there was this resurgence of interest in it, it was still an extremely small minority of Irish people who actually enjoyed the music, actually had any thought for it but contempt. In fact, the contempt for it was so pervasive and so great that I didn't even notice it at first. It was over my head, basically.
I was 3 years in the States, and I came back at Christmas. I took the vacation of 1 year, the year, and then I took the vacation of the next year and put the two of them together, and I had 4 weeks. That meant when I went back, I had no vacation or no holidays the next year, and it was rather sad. I don't know, could it be as bad going into jail? It was very hard. Your mind wasn't on your work for weeks and weeks after. Then for a while you forget about it. I was 11 days going there. And when I come back then the second time, and it was 8 years without coming back. And I came home in something less than 5 hours. And I was 6 and a half going back. I wanted to come back, very much so. But as I think I said it before, I was ashamed to come back. People would say I wasn't able to make out. And I'd have got to like it. It was a great country. There's no big shots there. They are big shots, but no one cares about them. They're left alone. And there's no class distinction there. And no matter who you are or what you are, the guy that's sweeping in the street is as good as you are. It's a different country to the country that I left entirely. But still, it's a good country if you want to make out in it. And there's the other side to it too. If you want to spend all your life in a bar and forget about work, you'll find it very awkward. You'll soon wind up down the Bowery.
It wasn't so much Sligo town, which I got in. I'd arrived with my family in Ireland to find, you know, as a cultural refugee, as I was saying, and had to find a place to stay. We went up for a bit to the north, to Antrim, to stay with a friend of ours who had bought a house just outside of Ballycastle, and that was pleasant enough. But he was. He was rich and famous and could afford to buy his house and enter and fix it up. And we were just basically looking for a place to exist. We came back down to Dublin because that seemed the logical place to be. We'd met some people down here, but it was obviously not the place for us to be. It was a bit depressing. It was like January of 1972 by this time. And I decided that I'd go on a scouting trip around the country and in a counterclockwise direction. So because we'd been to the north, I took the train up to Sligo and was intending to sort of make my way around the coast. So I got to Sligo on a Tuesday night. And this is back when Wednesday was market day in Sligo, so the whole town would be like closed. Closed after 12 o'clock noon. And I right away met some people who told me about some other Americans who had been living in Sligo and had vacated this house out in the country. And my antenna went up, and the fellow I was talking to very nicely telephoned the owner of the house, and the owner of the house took me out there. Now, up to this point, I wasn't particularly enthused by anything in Sligo. It seemed very much like all the other places I'd been in Ireland. But on the road out to the house where we eventually lived for 7 years, I got this very strange feeling. I noticed that for some bizarre reason, I recognized the place. It didn't belong to any of my memories, but I had this strange feeling that I knew this place that we were going to. I knew the house that we went to. I knew the surrounding hillside. I knew everything about it. And so with this buzz still in my mind, I came back to Dublin and collected my family, and we went down there to live.
Motion makes a man, and all true sailors go atop of it, where all true sailors see and always wait, always will the wave as truth, the ocean as what might be.
One of the first discoveries I made after I'd been living in Sligo for a little bit was the queer, comforting feeling that everything in Sligo was the right size and shape and speed and color for me. These colors and shapes and speeds and sizes were all radically different from the ones that you'd find in California. If this were as gloomy a country as people think it is, it might be fairly dire. But I think that's the key of it. A friend of mine living down at a particular place in Sligo for about 3 years running was in the same place. She's an American, in the same place for three summers in a row. And she took a series of photographs out her front door, looking across Ballisadare Bay, down towards Enniscrone and the mountains down on that side of the thing. And she must have had a series of about 36 pictures, all of them of exactly the same landscape, from exactly the same point of view, and not one of them looked like it was the same place.
I came here on every Friday, and I looked out at the waves lapping, and it was a good day and the scenery was beautiful. And I was kind of, after coming back, I was kind of bewitched by what I saw on the and all that, and I got a place. Then I bought it in Mamunda. And then after going back, I could kick myself. I said, what the hell did I want this for? More of a headache. So it's a place to stay, and I spend time here and I spend time over there, and I like it back and forth. And it's not much to travel. I could, before, years ago when I used to come home, it took me as long to go down to the West as I would be back in America. So the world has changed, very much so. I didn't find the real changes until, like, I used to come, when I used to come, I was coming on a vacation, and the bright side was always on the outside and it looked good. But when you come home here to live, to spend time here, and that you don't have to get up in the morning, I found out that it was much, much different. I'd say, did the people change? But no, maybe they didn't. Maybe it was me that changed. And then there's a bus stop outside of my door. I look out at the bus stop and I see the people going to work. And then I'd say to myself, oh, I'm a waster. No job, no nothing. I couldn't get used to it, not getting up and going to work. It took me a long time to get used to it. I might sometimes, and sometimes I get very fed up with it too. I put it in the case, I wouldn't take it for weeks. But I still, it's a kind of a tranquilizer. I like it. It's a help for you. It's a great mental help for you.
For me, there can be no beauty without change. That's a fundamental principle of whatever religion I have managed to develop for myself. That's the notion of life without death would be a complete joke. The notion of beauty without change is an absolute farce. Plastic flowers. I mean, the first time I saw a plastic flower, I almost vomited in horror. It was the idea of it was just so wrong. The beauty is in not just the curve and the color, it's in the ephemeral nature of it, the fact that it's going to change. That's what Ireland has. It has life and death. It has beauty with change. It has checks with reason. It has all kinds of other things that fit, that either have informed my philosophy or are in fact big chunks of it. It would be Knocknarea. Now, I'm not as fond of a spot called Ross's Point as other people are. Other people have associations of the golf course and Osties and sailing and stuff like that. But there's one thing that I treasure Ross's Point for, and that's that it is the most heartbreakingly beautiful view of Knocknarea. You get its full length. You can see the cairn very clearly. And it's not brooding at all. If you under the Ballastadere side of it, it's sometimes the weight of the cliff hanging over you is a bit intimidating. But from the Ross's Point side, you can see that it's simply an omphalos, a knot, an umbilicus of the world itself, which is a good way of thinking of Ireland in general. It's definitely the only way to think of Sligo.
Even when you went to dances, you taught people in Ireland had money and that they had better this and better that than you had. And when you come down to reality, it was the same for all that came. I mean, we all had to leave and go out there to better ourselves. And in the end, I can't think of anyone that didn't do pretty good. And in the end, all you get is 6 foot, not 1 inch more than the guy that had millions.